Florida Basketball, our podcast, is brought to you by the Gatorverse, an exclusive community dedicated to connecting University of Florida fans and student-athletes. Members receive access to exclusive autographed collectibles, real-life experiences, giveaways, VIP events, rewards, and athletes receive a majority of revenue from sales of their collectibles. That's the way that NIL is supposed to work. To find out more about becoming a Gatorverse member and Lockermania, visit Gatorverse.io. That's Gatorverse.io. Hello and welcome to Florida Basketball Hour. I am Neil Blackman, Saturday Down South, joined by Eric Fawcett, GatorCountry.com. Eric, Gators open up the season Monday night in the O-Dome with a pretty comfortable W, obviously a blazing start. I think they were up 16-0 before Loyola got on the board and kind of cruised from there.
Yeah, that win probability chart is a straight red line from start to finish. A pure sight when you're looking at the KenPom game probability charts. So yeah, to jump out to a lead like that, to just kind of control things no matter what, it seemed like the bench gave a pretty good boost of energy. In the second half, Loyola, their starters kind of got to Florida's bench a little bit, but you know, that was in the second half when the game was largely over with. And so yeah, I would say it was it went just about as well as it could have for the Gators. Like, yes, there's a couple of things that you could nitpick at, but I think just like generally speaking, to open your season with a kind of wire to wire holding a 20-point lead for much of the game, I think that that's just exactly what you probably could hope for. So definitely a success opening night.
Yeah, obviously the excitement from the fan base, and I think rightly so in a lot of ways, surrounds the bigs. 16 from Micah Hanlockton, 15 from Tyrese Samuel, 13 from Alex Condon. I guess Thomas Hawk got in the action there a little bit in the second half and scored some points, but definitely impressive. They made 5 3-pointers. I put a joking poll up about whether or not they would make 5 in the next 5 games or whatever, but a good start for Florida's front court.
Yeah, they'll probably be an adjusted line there at Windy's Winners Sportsbook. So look for Jake to try to take your money that way. But I think that was definitely a strength, and just kind of the energy level of that group just generally was something that just looked very different than Florida teams of the past. That mix of like length and like high activity, especially with I would say Condon embodying both of those things perfectly. Yeah, it just was a very different look than we've seen from the Gators recently. And then you sprinkle in the 3-pointers made, like you mentioned, which from Golden sounds like they expected a bit from Condon, maybe didn't expect from Hanlockton. So we'll see exactly what sticks and what doesn't. But this was definitely a game where when you're playing a lesser opponent in terms of kind of talent, athleticism, all that, it's just kind of like generally speaking, and we're seeing it all across college basketball. We see this every year. This isn't any new development, but I feel like when you see mid-major teams going against high major teams, it's like oftentimes the guards can kind of hang, but it's the front courts that really kind of differentiate the different levels of basketball. And I think that this was a situation where Florida's front court just completely overwhelmed. And again, it's not to say that Loyola's front court wasn't good. I thought Golden DK, like if we're looking for one thing to push back on, like I would say the biggest issue with Florida's front court was that Golden DK came in the game and just bodied every single one of Florida's centers, whether it was Hanlockton, whether it was Samuel, whether it was Condon. He was just carving out space. Like, he caught the ball 14 feet from the rim and in 3 dribbles was underneath the hoop, finishing with a layup just with pure strength. That would be the one thing about Florida's front court, which I'll be interested, Neil, if you have any issues there, but or anything, any comment on the fact that that Golden DK was physically manhandling Florida's front court. But I think that there was even a situation in the last couple of years where the Gators couldn't physically overwhelm lesser opponents, and it made for some uncomfortably close games or some losses that you just kind of thought, how did Florida let this one slip away? Where I think that this deep, active, long front court of Florida should help them really kind of take control of games they should have control in, such as this one.
Yeah, I think those are great points, Eric. So I had two issues with the front court, and they were both kind of minor. One was, Golden DK, not only did he body people, but like he just got fouled constantly. Like Florida's ability to not foul somebody who's playing physical with them was maybe that moves from mild concern to sort of moderate concern, even though Florida obviously won by 20, nearly covered the 22 and a half or whatever, 21 and a half. Golden DK drew 8 fouls. 6 of his fouls drawn were in the second half. Granted, they were against young players for Florida, but you'd like to see if Florida's going to get pushed around a little bit physically, you'd like to see them at least, maybe not have everyone fouling all the time. At least that's me. And then Micah Hanlockton, and this is both a good and a bad, and I'm interested in kind of your take on that. I didn't see anything that changed for him defensively, really, after he picked up the early 2 fouls, which I think is a big positive. Obviously, it's unfortunate that he got 2 fouls in the game's first 6 minutes or whatever. But credit Todd Golden for putting him back in with 2 fouls. And I think, credit Micah for playing well and avoiding a third.
Well, like, and again, this is hot take season all across college basketball where we overreact to one game. But so if I was to say one overreaction and one underreaction or just something I've kind of said regularly, like my overreaction or possible overreaction would be that Alex Condon is much better and more ready to contribute at this level than I expected. He looked obviously very good. And, Micah Hanlockton is someone that I've kind of said consistently is someone that I think should be playing roughly 18 minutes a game and probably not closing games. So you put those two things together. And if Hanlockton picks up 2 fouls, well, with all due respect, I don't know if that's a guy you need to be protecting. That's not someone that I'm like, oh, well, if Micah Hanlockton fouls out, the Gators have no chance against a good opponent, not just in this game, but not that I think it's wise basketball to go out there and foul everyone, but I don't think Hanlockton should be playing with any bit of like, oh man, I better, not contest this layup because I need to be there for my team late in the second half. I think he should be free to play kind of aggressively. Again, the fouls he picked up when he was just getting bodied by a low major center, like those are ones that you'd rather not see. It's not like, but I'd like to see him aggressively trying to block shots, knowing that like, oh, if I pick up a cheap one or, oh, I probably got all ball, but they called the foul, or, oh, I gave a hard foul to give up a layup. Like with the way that Florida clearly has belief in Alex Condon and even Hauk. I wouldn't be fearful of playing Hanlockton with fouls because if he fouls out, I don't think the drop off is going to be that big. We will see by the end of the season. But and then of course you add in that 2 foul participation is not something that that Golden is scared by, which we greatly appreciate. And I will say, Neil, you've been on the train of Hanlockton fouls too much and is going to foul too much at this level. So I'm sure you were, just slightly as much as you didn't want to express happiness at Hanlockton picking up 2 fouls so quickly. I'm sure you were smirking at it.
Well, I smirked at the second one, right? Cause it's just a pure ball denial situation off an inbound pass. Mm. And like, he cannot do that. That's one where if it's your player at a high school level, I'm going to grab him on his way off the court and just say, you cannot do that to your team.
The first one, like you said, he's aggressive. He's trying to block a shot. Okay. Like, I live with that early foul. And I do, especially for a lot of the reasons you're saying. I think those are, you know, great points. The second one is the one that irritates you, because that's harmful. It adds a cheap foul, not to you, but also to the team's tally. And that there's just no point to do that in a pure ball denial scenario. So those are the little things he's got to learn. And to his credit, I thought, you know, he did. He responded. He didn't commit another foul. Now, he was the lowest of the whatever you want to put into plus minus with the way that these rotations worked on opening night. When you get a 16-0 lead, I think his plus seven was the lowest of the Florida front court. Samuel was the highest, plus 23. And no one will be surprised by that. And yeah, I think Samuel was one of the guys I tweeted about where I said, you know, you can see why you and I were really high on him, and you saw it pretty quickly in the game's first 15 minutes.
Yeah, that was definitely Tyre Samuel very quickly put his name kind of out there for any fans who like didn't really know about him. It was nice to see again him try to dunk on everyone. I think he had two where he was fouled, but you just kind of like to see that aggression, and something that again you just have not seen from Florida bigs in the last couple of years, whether just from an athleticism standpoint or just that kind of ability to go up there. And it's crazy to see Tyre Samuel again. We kind of talked a couple of podcasts ago about how he's probably not 6'10". He kind of looks like, well, and again, maybe I shouldn't say this because it's going to bring up a name that people maybe don't love, but like, he kind of looks like Omar Payne. Like, he's like, cause it looks like he's probably 6'8", but his like wingspan is massive. So he moves like really well, because he's not like super bulky and massive, but then when he goes up to catch lobs, he just has, you know, really good like in high point balls, because he's got this massive wingspan and huge hands, and it was just fun to see. And the Gators going back to the film, and by film I mean the highlights that Florida tweeted out of their scrimmage against Miami, they got two lobs on empty side ball screens with the other big ducking in, and they got that exact alley-oop on an empty side ball screen with a duck in to Samuel. So clearly that's kind of working for them. And I think too, just some of the rebounding was great to see, some of that physicality. I'm very interested. Can't wait to see Tyre Samuel playing some of these SEC bigs. But yeah, it definitely looked very, very good in this setting against Loyola.
Well, we're going to get to this. I'm not jumping the Loyola game yet, but I mean, we're going to get some immediate answers about just how effective he is in a couple days. We'll get to that. Riley Kugel, man. So like, first half, didn't really let kind of a slow start offensively affect him defensively, other than a bad possession at the end of the half, which was kind of glaringly bad. And I think he got beat up on Twitter for it, but like was otherwise really good, I thought, on defense in the first half. But, you know, one thing that's so nice about his game is like just how under control the drives are into the paint. Didn't see him being that under control on night one, I'll be honest.
Yeah, it was pretty good. And his finishing at the rim numbers were tweeted out by like some draft guy, which I thought was nice, considering that was one of the things I talked about on kind of recent podcasts about how he didn't finish at the rim particularly well last year. But he was like, I forgot what it was. Now I forgot what the tweet was, but I think he had like 7 buckets at the rim or something. He was like 7 for 9 or 7 for 10 or 8 for 10 or something. And he had some nice finishes at the rim. He also had one that I thought was like vintage bad finishing at the rim, where he extended really early and was off balance and missed a cheap one. I think that actually turned into like a handlocked and put back dunk or something, but still think he's got a little bit of work to do there. But I do think, like you said, it was the actual drives were under control. And then the other thing I will say is I thought, and again, real ones who saw the Patreon video will know that not only was he not a great finisher at the rim, but he just gets there, or last year, I shouldn't say gets there. Last year, he got there way less than you think, because it just seemed like every time he got the ball, whether it was in an isolation or pick and roll setting, it was like, get to the step back, get to the step back, get to the step back. And even if he like kind of drove, it was because he was trying to get a defender to bite to get to a step back.
Yeah.
And for someone who's as athletic as he is, that just can't be his first, second, and third option. So just to see that more aggression going downhill. And then the other thing I thought was kind of, I thought maybe noticeable to me, maybe different. Like, I know he put up points, but it was like, I felt like he was trying to pass every time he drove the ball. Like, I felt like he was like making a concerted effort to be a playmaker more than a scorer. And I thought that that was something in the offseason he continued, because I, again, his reputation, and rightfully so, it's something that I said myself was like, hey, his distribution numbers are not very good. His playmaking numbers are not very good. I thought looking at the film, he was, didn't make a lot of great reads. And in the offseason, he talked a lot about the fact that he was more than a scorer, that he wanted to be someone who's a playmaker. I think he echoed that sentiment as well in the post game, and that he just is more than a scorer. And I thought that it was like, he scored 23 points efficiently when, like, it seemed like he actually was trying to like get 10 assists, but he just had to take, you know, had to take the shots at the rim when it came to him. And that's what I think was a recipe for such a great game for him, was that it wasn't like 23 points with a lot of high opportunity costs. It seemed like he really shared the ball. He found teammates for open looks. He obviously had a decent number of assists, but then you're also like, oh yeah. And he also scored efficiently 23 points.
Yeah. 4 assists, 8 of 10 finishing at the rim. The tweet from Zach Milner, I retweeted, so people know we're recording Thursday morning. So if you're going to go look for that on the Florida Basketball, our Twitter timeline, you'll find it at like 11 a.m. on November 9th. It's there. There's some highlights of those finishes at the rim. And yeah, real ones do know about the Patreon. So make sure that you go to Florida BB Hour and get subscribed to our Patreon so you can watch the video breakdown Eric did. Because a lot of things he talked about were like openly stuff that it appears Riley Kugel worked on night one. And you saw them. And then I thought, and I tweeted this out during the game, that I love the way he was aggressive defensively, but also kind of showing a high IQ defensively. He wasn't going for steals just to go for steals. He, you know, I think he was 6 for 7 when he I think there was one time where he didn't get a steal that he went for, and he was able to recover pretty quickly. He had kind of one bad possession in transition that happens. But first Gator since Kavarius Hayes in the 2017 NCAA tournament to have 6 steals in a game. Casey Prather was the last guy to do it before that. So gives you an idea of you know, how good a game that is to get 6 steals and just be committed to being committed on defense, especially when, you know, he was 0-for-3 from 3-point range. And I saw some tweets about body language. And honestly, I just think that that's just kind of Riley Kugel's personality. Like, you're never going to sell me that his body language is bad when he has 6 steals, man.
Yeah, I wouldn't be too concerned about, like if Florida lost a bunch of games in a row or something, like, later in the season. I thought his body language could have been bad last year, and you would have been like, yeah, that's fair. Like, if in the last couple weeks of the season last year he had bad body language while he was the only Gator able to score, like, I don't know, that would have been even justifiable if that was the case. But I don't really remember his body language being bad back then, and I don't think that he had it did not jump out to me. And I don't plan on looking back to see if his body language was bad against Loyola. I thought it was, I thought he just got, and I don't say this as like a negative. Cause I some people say this in like, it's because they're saying a guy's not working hard, but I feel like he was in like second gear all game. So I didn't even like, I just felt like he wasn't even working that hard. And again, I don't say that as a negative. I just thought it was like, that's how easy the game came to him. And I feel like he has multiple more gears to go. And you can't do that every single game. And if he can play really smart and pick his spots to shoot gaps and get steals and try to find his teammates as much as possible in a bye game, that's great. And I think he's got a couple more gears that he could have easily shifted up to if he wanted to. And maybe we see that against Virginia or a game like that. But In kind of, again, the fashion of saying that the game went, like, you know, essentially as well as possible for the Gators. And like, yes, there's whatever, still no game is perfect, but it's like Riley Kugel looking like he hardly broke a sweat in playing an awesome basketball game, I think has to be a massive positive, just in the sense that if Florida is going to be good, they need Riley Kugel to be awesome and first team SEC caliber. And if someone thought that was going to be the case, game one returns against Loyola would be there.
Yeah, they would. You know, another guy that I thought should be discussed before we get into Friday is Alex Condon. I thought a couple of Florida's rotational breakdowns leading to kind of wide open looks for Loyola in the second half were Condon kind of getting lost, whether he got underneath a screen or just kind of didn't rotate. So some defensive learning curve there, but obviously, it looks like Florida has somebody with some skill in terms of what he can offer offensively.
I do think that there was, and again, I thought it was interesting that Florida really trusted like the bench unit to kind of play together. So there was some Hal Condon minutes, and both of those guys had some bad moments guarding actions. That's your first collegiate game. So it's not nothing to be super concerned about. You definitely saw just like physically they step on the floor. Noticeably have great size. Again, energy level was absolutely there. And then Condon getting it done in a number of ways, whether of course the three pointers, which looked great, looked completely improved form from what he had in Australia. So you love to see that improvement. Of course, in transition, like again, I've said it on the podcast, and like it, I'll just say it again, like he just like runs angry, like he runs like a 5'10", 210 pound running back who just like runs angry, he runs angry. I also thought he had really good hands on a couple of moments, made some tough catches. Again, just not to have to go back to this, but like. You saw Han Lockton show some pretty bad moments catching the ball on entry passes. And then you saw Alex Condon have some really good moments. So just like on similar plays where it's like, oh, Condon's has a little bit of that touch. And that was noticeable coming off of some of the Han Lockton turnovers. And I just think that for Condon to be productive in a number of ways that like, I don't think he's going to go 2 for 2 from 3 every single game, but even if he didn't hit those 2 3-point shots, it would have been a awfully successful game for him. And then of course you add in the shooting upside that we now know is very much there. And you have someone that like, I think I said on Windy's Winners that a bold take of Thomas Houck being a starter by the end of the season. And, again, if we are doing overreactions after one game, the overreaction would be that it would be Alex Condon pushing for that start, which I will credit Kevin Sweeney from Sports Illustrated, who said in the offseason that he was hearing that Alex Condon was pushing for a starting spot. He was certainly the only one who was reporting that. And again, early returns on that one would be, I'm not saying this is what the Gators should do. But should if the Gators were like, hey, Alex Condon's starting on Friday, you know, it wouldn't be crazy. That would be the game one overreaction if you wanted to go with that.
Yep, I like it. Walter Clayton, first game as a Gator, pretty steady. You know what I think you see with Walt, Eric, is just kind of the ability to play super under control, but offer a little more, but also play like more quickly than Kyle Lofton, who sometimes appeared to be operating in slow motion at times, and Walter can change speeds with the ball, but a lot of that is all under control. We saw his stroke, which is beautiful from deep. He missed 5 free throws all of last year. He missed 3 on opening night. That was weird. If Preston Green were still around, we could night one overreact about why he's stronger. So he ironed a bunch of free throws. Luckily, we don't have to do any of that speculating. It was just one of those weird basketball things that you wouldn't ever expect to happen. But, any thoughts on Walter? I thought just all told a good game, instructive that he was second on the team in minutes too.
Yeah, he also put up some surprising to me. He like quietly put up assist numbers that were really good. He led the team with 5. Like just watching the flow of the game, I would not have expected that. And again, I still think like, and part of that is like, I still think he's best just like off the ball. Still think he's best as a catch and shoot player who can attack kind of in straight lines. Like, again, I wasn't watching this game thinking like, wow, the Gators are in desperate need of Zion Pullen, because they obviously controlled it just fine. But I still was like thinking, watching the way things shook out, that like, man, like this team is going to look even much, much, much better with Zion Pullen on the floor. So I thought that that's where Clayton looked the best. Also, if we were going to, you know, in the past, we would see guys like Clayton coming in much heavier with a bunch of added muscle in the upper body, and they're, you know, and they'd lose some of their movement in addition to their shooting stroke, where clearly his shooting stroke looks fine from three, and he had the chase down block, which again, you're just like, when have you seen a Florida point guard be able to chase someone down and pin a layup on the backboard? Like, that's that kind of athleticism from that spot is great. And I also thought he played well defensively, just as a guy who can help in the gaps and be quick stunting and getting back to the ball. So yeah, I thought he played a good, like, solid game. And he gets the leader in the clubhouse of like, what do the Gators look like with him in the starting lineup or playing big, whatever, before Pullen comes. Again, if we're delivering, we have to deliver just takes on everything with a tiny sample size of one game. Maybe I'm wrong because he had five assists, but I still think that he will look best playing off the ball. And yeah. I think that while he had the ball in his hands a decent amount and did make some good play, yeah, I'm still looking for him to be more of a role off the ball. And, you know, I think I wrote about the fact that I would love to see him take like six or seven or eight threes a game. He took two. I would just like to see. And actually, after you address Walter Clayton, or if you have anything more to say on that, I'm curious on your thoughts on the fact that the Gators only shot 16 threes. And if you take out the 4 3-pointers made by the combination of Micah Hanlockton and Alex Gaughan, and there was not a lot there. Like, do you have, again, overreactions to one game? Is that, do you have any comment on only 16 3-point attempts from the Gators?
Yeah, it was interesting. I think Florida's ability and Riley Kugel's ability to get inside and finish kind of undermined, you know, well, it not undermined, it eliminated the need for Florida to hoist a bunch from deep. They never really got Will Richard going. I thought one of Will's threes was not a three I want him taking. It's kind of like an inbound catch and shoot that was well guarded. I thought Will had another wide open one that he missed. And that was kind of it. Walter Clayton passed up a wide open three and then passed to Kugel, who drove the lane, scored, and got fouled. You know, I don't have any issue with that. It's interesting because I do think Florida is built to shoot the three better, but in the secret scrimmages, and again, Monday night, they haven't necessarily wanted to shoot a ton of three-pointers. Their high was the 24 attempts in the Miami win. But, you know, they also haven't made a ton yet. They're shooting, you know, so it was good, I'm sure, to see like Alex Condon have it go in. I will tell you in like five games if it was good for Micah Hanlockton to see a couple go in. or not, like, you almost like no, yes, and then oh no again when that happens, because you're like, you don't want him to start thinking that, you know, that's what he needs to be doing offensively. I don't know if I answered your question. Like, I guess I'm not that concerned about it, or really my answer is like incomplete because the sample size is pretty small.
Yeah, I just think it's interesting. I don't think it's a bad sign or anything. Like, the goal of basketball is to be efficient. And going back to even the scrimmages, like you said, the Gators have been efficient offensively. They were efficient in the two scrimmages, and they scored 93 points efficiently against Loyola. So I'm not really, you know, too concerned with how they get there. And I think it could be an instance where they were getting to the rim. They're getting good shots in the paint, and there was just like not a need. Like, yeah, some of these ones are passed up, but generally speaking, I think there's going to be games where the Gators are going to need to shoot more threes, And I'm hoping to see that Walter Clayton volume cranked up. That would be, he would just be the one guy that he passed up some that I was, that I thought was curious. And maybe it was just something where there was clearly, like, the Gators were trying to move the ball a lot. And maybe that was just a focus in a game that they knew that they should win. They wanted that ball to pop as much as possible. Or maybe it's because he was went 1-for-6 in both exhibition games. Maybe that's something, and he still feels like he needs to find it a little bit. I don't know. We'll find out. But it was like, if we're looking for, like, notable stats, it would be the combination of only 16 three-point attempts, six were made, but 4 came from the centers. Like, that, it was interesting. It's something to watch for, but certainly not a game one overreaction concern.
Yeah, totally. I think Florida will shoot more for threes Friday, and maybe that's a good way to transition to what lies ahead of Florida on Friday. This is the first time prior to the 2015 season that Virginia enters the season unranked. It's been a while. By the way, that Virginia team that entered the year unranked in 2015 went 30-4, won the Atlantic Coast Conference Championship, and then lost a rock fight with Michigan State in the second round of the NCAA tournament. So their response to not being ranked in the preseason was to win 30 games. I'm not saying that they're going to do that this year. I'm not saying I'm even capable of an objective Tony Bennett take. and I offer that up for the next 30 minutes that follow. But I will say that, yeah, it has been a while since a UVA team entered the year unranked. It also is totally understandable, quite honestly. I mean, they lost 5 of their top 7 scorers. It's the first time, I think, since the Obama administration that Kihi Clark isn't their point guard. I don't know if it's actually that long, but it's darn close. There is a lot of turnover. Now, all that said, I think they're a little more talented than people think. Like, I think Ryan Dunn is a guy. Eric does a lot of NBA draft work. I'm sure Eric's familiar with him because of that, or at least to some extent. Isaac McNeely played really well down the stretch last year as another guard that they have. And then they have Gator killer Jacob Groves. Florida fans will be thrilled, I'm sure, to see him attempt to go 8,000-0 in his career against the Gators. And then he transferred from Oklahoma. So there's some players there, just a lot of unknowns, all surrounded by All-American Reese Beekman.
Yeah, I would probably be, you mentioned that some people, or you think they're more talented than some people, or however you just worded it. Like, I would probably be in the camp of people that don't think they're super talented. Like, I think Reese Beekman is really good. So he's a senior point guard. I think he has started every single game or like close to every game. I think he started all but like 4 or 5 in 3 years. So he's like a true senior. I believe this is his like 4th season, not a COVID senior. And he is just like rock solid, steady. He showed it in the first game of their season against Tarleton State. He had 7 assists and 0 turnovers. Just kind of so Beekman is like fantastic defender. Always like plays with his head up in transition, coming off of ball screens. The knock with him is just that he is not someone who is a big time scorer. Not someone who's great creating for himself. That's kind of a similar knock for many Virginia players in the past. So some people think that's just because he's a Virginia player that that's the knock. But I think he is like the coach's dream, super intelligent offensive player, great defensive player, good size of the point guard position, tough nose. Like, he's like the coach's dream point guard. But the situation for Virginia is always going to be, what happens when the actions don't work and it gets into a late shot clock situation, like who's going to get you a bucket. And I think that that's where Virginia, as has been the case in the last 4 seasons since they won the national championship, I don't know if they totally have that guy. A player who's taken on a bigger role is Isaac McNeely. He came off the bench last season and hit 39% of his threes. And so he's taken on a much bigger role this season where Virginia needs that kind of scoring. And he was 4-for-8 from the 3-point line in their opening game. Yeah, again, he's someone who I would consider mostly a catch and shoot player at this point in his career. I don't think he has a lot more to his game. Again, that's a guy who I think the Gators would love to have the ball at the end of a shot clock, because I don't think he has a whole lot of juice. He's turnover prone. And then again, I think the biggest thing that strikes me about this Virginia team is they do lack that big center that they have had when they've been successful. I think it's so important to their defensive scheme to have a big body to hedge ball screens and control the glass. And this year you look at their front court, and like you mentioned, Neil, it's 6'9", 215 pound Jacob Groves. So I think it's just a team that lacks kind of front court physicality and size. And they've got a really solid, steady point guard, but not one that can go get a bucket. So, it's a very interesting matchup, and it doesn't need to be. This is as obvious, bare bones analysis as it gets. But you know, everyone knows Virginia wants to play as slow as possible and methodically as possible, and the Gators are going to try to play as fast as possible. And after playing a really fast game, Tari Samuel said, we think we could have played, you know, a lot faster. So it's going to be the clash of styles that makes for an interesting game. So, and for that reason, I'm very excited for it.
Yeah, it's going to be fantastic. I'll be there. So if people want to come and say hello, please come and say hello. I think the Ben Vanderblas injury last year was so big, because even though he wasn't like, you know, they had Caden Shedrick, but Vanderplas was so important because he was 6'8", but athletic, right? Like, and sneaky athletic on the glass, able to stretch defenses offensively. And Tony Bennett said, like, we did not rebound as well when Ben went out. We did not stress defenses as well when Ben went out, and that hurt Virginia late. It's how you lose 30 games and then lose to Furman. I do think, you know, it'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see, like, just how good they can be defensively. Obviously, in their opener, they looked like they're suffocating selves. Tarleton State is a team that was kind of middle of the road in the WAC. They're coached by Billy Gillespie. A lot of people will be familiar with him. I don't think he's a tremendous basketball coach, but, you know, it is what it is. They really crushed them, just suffocated them, held them to 0.79 points per possession. Those are types of things that you kind of have grown to expect. But as Eric said, they've always had these big kind of rangy athletes at the big positions, and there is no Caden Shedrick type. I mean, they have Jacob Groves, who's a lot smaller. They also have a guy in Ryan Dunn who I think can play four positions probably, who they think is the next monster defensively. Now, they already have the reigning ACC Defensive Player of the Year in Reese Beekman. They think that Ryan Dunn is kind of the next guy up. But, you know, their defense kind of does depend a little bit on having that man in the middle, and it's not obvious who that is this season, Eric. I do think that they're going to score the ball a little bit better than people think. Obviously, Beekman looked tremendous in the opener with 16 points. He had 7 assists. He didn't turn the ball over. They really, really, really like Dante Harris, the Georgetown transfer, who, remember, was the player of the tournament when Georgetown made that weird run through the Big East tournament. So, again, it's a proven Power 6 player that they've added. And then Isaac McNeely, who I don't think is super athletic, but I do think packed some scoring punch late in the season last year. It'll be interesting to see, like, what he offers. You know, Dante Harris did not have a great game in their opener. You know, can he bounce back? Is he the kind of player that can bounce back? And then I think a lot of people will be interested to see that Beekman versus Kugel matchup on the perimeter, because quite honestly, for 2 years, Virginia has put Reese Beekman on the other team's best player, and more times than not, it's worked.
Yeah, and it's going to be interesting to, like you keep talking about how these guys are all like the next guy up for Virginia, and that's something that Tony Bennett is still trying to hold on to. Of course, in the transfer portal era, he's someone who is very much into still wanting to develop guys. He had some like somewhat concerning, well, I'll say concerning comments in the offseason that like he hopes that every offseason doesn't look like this. And everyone kind of inferred that it was talking about like the portal and like guys yeah. leaving. So like, I just feel like, and who, you know, don't know what the NIL situation is there, because they could have great NIL, and I think that Bennett would have still tried to just keep his guys and develop, or they could have bad NIL, and that's what led him to do exactly what he wanted. But like,
yeah,
one guy in the portal was kind of notably was Jordan Miner from Merrimack. He's like an undersized big who doesn't really shoot the ball, but is like kind of really smart and savvy. And it's just like, yeah, I feel like they could have used the, like, I feel like that would have been a place where you could have attracted the kind of center that really could have been used for that style, or you know, bringing in someone who's a little bit more of a raw athlete that would fit perfectly in their system of like, because they play so methodically and out of a system, like getting an athlete who can kind of go through the choreography of that offense, who maybe has struggles making reads and feeling the game, but would work perfectly going through a really choreographed offense. Like, yeah. So I'll be interested to see where Virginia kind of goes generally. But yeah, they do have a young player in Blake Buchanan who plays that kind of, you know, just is that big frame that I feel they kind of need. But their other transfers, Andrew Rohde, who's from St. Thomas, who just, you know, recently went to Division One, and he was a really productive freshman. And this was kind of like a Will Richardy rare transfer. You don't often see where he played 1 year at St. Thomas and was really good and transferred, you know, mid-major to high major after freshman season, which you don't see very often. So the Will Richard transfer, now that's Andrew Rohde. But and I think that that's the guy who could surprise. He played some big minutes against Tarleton State and was 2 for 5 from three, which is great. He is a big time, or, you know, showed potential as a big time shooter. He got really cold and really hot as a freshman. But yeah, it's I'm just interested to see what the future is of Virginia basketball, given that given the kind of the way that Tony Bennett wants to build his teams, and I think we'll see a good idea on Friday, where we've got like the more developed internally team versus the transfer team, and not that that's going to be the clear delineation of what style is better for current college basketball, but. Yeah, it just makes the matchup that much more interesting between the team that wants to play fast, full of transfers, versus the kind of internally built team that wants to play slow and in a system. It's going to be interesting. And I do think going back to Riley Kugel and the way he played, this is going to be the first kind of test for him playing in ball screens, where, like I said, I didn't think he was great as a freshman, but of course he was just a freshman. And now he's going to go against a Virginia team that's traditionally going to hard hedge and try to send that ball handler away from the middle of the floor back towards center court and try to make someone else beat them. I'm just interested to see, like, is he going to get ambitious and try to like split these hard hedges, and maybe it turns into a wide open three or a layup because of it, or it turns into a turnover, or is he going to kind of take what the game gives to him, or is he just going to straight beat the hedge with his quickness? Like that's kind of one of the bigger things that I'm interested in. And when they had, you know, 7-footers playing that role, I think that was a lot tougher to do than when it's Jacob Groves hard hedging ball screens. So it's also going to be interesting for Virginia to now test their defensive system that maybe doesn't have the prototypical players for it against a team in the Gators that has, you know, pretty good athleticism and speed.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to talk about that system. Obviously Reese Beekman is kind of the anchor of that defense, projected as an early second round pick in the Athletic mock, a late first round pick in the CBS mock, I think was gone last year, but then hurt his hamstring. And Eric alluded to the fact that he actually didn't start a few games last year. That's because he was coming off a hamstring injury and they kind of eased him back in. They also, Blake Buchanan is a top 100 recruit. They played him 17 minutes the other night, but like Eric said, less less traditional than they've usually been. Todd Golden, not his first time facing the Virginia pack line. Probably his first big win as a head coach came against Virginia, 61-60 win in Bubbleville. Interestingly, a game the Gators were supposed to play against Virginia, but because of COVID did not get to. So San Francisco was subbed in and then won a game that had 62 possessions, 61-60. San Francisco shot 28 threes in that game and made 13 of them. The Gators are going to have to make some threes, Eric. The pack line, for people that aren't as familiar, I mean, it is a man-to-man defense. It just looks a little different. It's a sagging kind of man-to-man difference. The pack line is like an imaginary thing. It's an imaginary line about the way Virginia plays it is usually about 2.5 feet below the three-point line. Eric can jump in if I'm wrong about any of this. But yeah, anywhere from 2 to 2.5 feet, there is high ball pressure. Eric mentioned it on the ball handler. They will do what they have to do to put pressure on him. They will also leave the pack line area and try to stop the ball with some of their hedges. But they immediately retreat back to the pack line. I think one of the biggest things that makes it valuable for Virginia is, like, in traditional man-to-man, you have, like, deny responsibility, help responsibility, recover responsibility. And, like, the pack line's kind of cool because all you have to do is help and recover, and you're already in a place to help, right? So, like, you eliminate really one of the fundamental responsibilities of man-to-man defense, and then they prevent dribble drive penetration by kind of drawing that line, arbitrary line in the sand, and being in a natural position to help each other on dribble drives, which is why Florida needs to make some threes, I think. Eric alluded to one thing that they do that I think Florida did well in the NCAA tournament game, which is hit flare cuts and back cuts. When they do come out of the pack line and try to stop the ball, it usually means that there's space behind the pack line defense that Florida can exploit. I don't know if in continuity ball screen, Florida is really equipped to exploit some of that stuff. I guess we'll find out.
Yeah, didn't see too much continuity on opening night. We didn't really talk about it, I guess, but we saw the Gators play a lot more of what Golden was doing at San Francisco. And I still remember, like, if anyone remembers the podcast we did with Golden last summer, I guess, or whatever it was. I kind of talked about it with Golden. I kind of always refer to it as like the West Coast ducking ball screens, because it's like all these teams in the WCC do it, where you have a high ball screen where the second big is just carving out space under the rim, and it just makes it so that it's difficult for teams that want to like tag a ball screen with the lowest man on the opposite side. It kind of takes away that guy completely. And it also allows ball handlers, if they gain an advantage, to get right to the rim. I alluded to the Tyree Samuel alley-oop he got, where that's exactly what happened. It was an empty side ball screen. Normally you'd have the lowest player on the opposite side tag that roller, but suddenly when you have a second big who's just pinning his man under the hoop, it's like, well, I guess that, you know, technically this defense is thinking, oh, our lowest guy on the opposite side is the big man under the rim, so he's responsible to take that role, but he can't because he's getting Alex Condon trying to seal him. So something you'll see Virginia do every time the ball gets inside is double team. Like, everything about the pack line defense is really to keep the ball away from the hoop. So a lot of the philosophies just all kind of align with that. So it's like, oh, there's a pick and roll. Okay, well, they're going to hard hedge the ball screen because they want to keep that ball as away from the hoop as much as possible. Whereas the Gators would drop a ball screen and they're comfortable letting the ball get into the middle of the floor and recovering. If someone posts up against Virginia, they want the ball as far away from the hoop as possible. So they're going to double team to get that ball away from the hoop as quickly as possible. Whereas the Gators would maybe be like, hey, we're going to trust our guys to play one-on-one there. So I think that's what's going to be interesting is when the Gators get the ball into their big men, how do they handle these double teams? Or how much do the Gators try to even get the ball in around the hoop in post-ups, or whether it's on short rolls against the hedge or anything like that? And operate like how some teams are trying to keep the ball out of the post because they don't trust their guys to make plays against Virginia double teams. And some teams say, oh, if they're going to double team, that's great. I want to invite that double team and play out of it. So that's going to be that's going to be something that's really interesting. But I think that the narrative of like you've got to make threes against Virginia, like on one hand, it's like overplayed by media because it's just like the easiest thing to say. It's like, oh, well, you know, you got to make shots or like, oh, you got to take threes. But like it certainly does soften up that defense.
Yeah.
And particularly it's not like it's not you're not going to hit that corner skip three pointer that you'll see against teams that play more denial, one pass away defense. Against the pack line, it's a defense that's helping from one pass away from the nearest players to the ball. So it's often just those wing to point threes. That's a short pass and maybe a little bit deeper of a three because that closeout is going to be short. And it's threes you don't get a lot in against kind of the man defenses you're used to playing. And I think that's part of the reason Virginia's had so much success is like they give up a lot of threes, but not always the threes the teams are used to taking. And it's one of those things that if the Gators can make those shots, it's one of those things that you don't have to run a lot of offense to get to. And I mentioned I wouldn't mind seeing Walter Clayton shoot six or seven or eight threes a game in most situations. Like this is a game where I'd probably be happy with him taking eight, you know, not wide. Like it's not like like they're going to be wide open. They're all going to be like B or B minus looks. But I would be happy with him taking eight B minus looks and seeing if he hits three of them. That's awesome. That's great. So I'm very interested though, just philosophically, how the Gators try to attack on Friday.
Yeah, another thing I'm interested in is Florida's matchup with Ryan Dunn, a guy I've mentioned. Eric, who I think, you know, Tony Bennett told me at ACC tip-off that he's just monstrous and that every DeAndre Hunter comparison is fair, and he wouldn't say that lightly. And I don't think Tony Bennett would say that lightly. He's like Riley Kugel, a guy who's just kind of shot up draft boards based on like some stuff he's done in the summer too, and how he's played. And it's weird because you're talking about a guy who played like 13 minutes a game last year and it averaged like 3 points a game. But I think it's like the 3-and-D skill set, right? And all that mismatchability. I just made up a word. Like 6'9" and legitimately that tall, where he can be on or off the ball and be disruptive because of his length. I think he's a good positional shot blocker. I think that he is a guy who is figuring out what he can do offensively, but I'm more worried about like, you know, Florida just being aware of him on the defensive end, because I don't think the Gators can afford to give up easy baskets to a team that I think, let's be honest, may struggle to score some this season.
Yeah. Like he is one of the guys that I could see, just like the athleticism at a smaller frame mismatch against, like if Micah Hanlockton has to guard him, if Alex Condon has to guard him, like I could see him just getting a kind of quick first step around them and turning it to fouls. Like that could be something where he sets a pin down and opens up to the ball and gets a slip, like little things like that. And again, these are the matchups that are going to test how viable playing bigger is going to be for the Gators. I guess like really the more matchup would be Tyree Samuel on Dunn to start more than like a Hanlockton, but it'll be interesting to see how even Samuel handles that kind of a matchup, or would Samuel be much better off on Jacob Groves? And it's just as we still have like questions about how different lineups are going to work for the Gators. Like, yeah, you know, I'm not going to learn a lot against Loyola, but you'll find out a lot against Virginia.
Yeah. So that's, as we get kind of wind down here, like, what are your thoughts on the scale of this game? It's the first of four games that the Gators will play against ACC opponents. I think at worst, it's a quad two game. It's never going to get beyond that. Has a chance to be a quad one game because it's on a neutral floor. You know, who knows? It really depends on where Virginia ends up at the end of the season. I'm sure Virginia is looking at it the same way. Like, man, if the Gators are good, this is a quad one opportunity for us. If Florida's average, it's going to be a quad two opportunity. But I think for me, this is a game where it's sort of like, let's see if Florida can put it all together early in the season against one of the better programs in the sport, right? And if you do that, then it's just confidence building. Like, irregardless of what ends up happening with it on Selection Sunday, I think that's the fairest, most reasonable I can be about this particular challenge.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important because as currently stands, Virginia is quite clearly the highest, like, KenPom team on Florida's non-conference schedule. So, and of course, like, if the Gators beat Pittsburgh and play Baylor, I think it'll be Baylor by a large margin. But right now, the Gators don't have a bunch of awesome opportunities on their schedule. And this currently stands as Florida's best. And again, if we're talking overreactions after one game, you know, Michigan's going to the Final Four because they blasted a really good UNC Asheville team. And while I do think there's some overreactions, I do think that Michigan might be a little bit better than consensus. But still, it's like this. It would not be unreasonable to suggest that this is Florida's most challenging from a resume standpoint non-conference game. And for that reason, it's a big one. The Gators don't have a bunch of quad one, quad 1A opportunities. I don't think this would be quad 1A, to be clear. It's like Florida chose to not have, in my opinion, a super challenging non-conference schedule. So these are the games you have to win, because if the Gators, you know, were to have a regular-ish performance in the SEC, if they finish seventh or eighth or ninth, and you know, say they were to lose this game, and say they were to lose to Pittsburgh and don't get Baylor, suddenly their resume is not looking so good. Whereas if you beat Virginia, yeah, maybe you beat Michigan later and you get to play Baylor and maybe lose that one competitively, and then you finish eighth in the SEC, you're still probably fine getting into the NCAA tournament. I'm not saying this is a make or break game for Florida to make the NCAA tournament, but a win here and suddenly you're starting to look like, okay, like Florida can make their way through the non-conference fairly solidly. And then a seventh or eighth finish in the SEC should be more than enough to get into the NCAA tournament. So yeah, I just think if you're going to schedule the way Florida does, it suddenly makes games like this very, very important. So yeah, I actually do think this is quite a large game. Of course, being that it's a big game, but you know, not one that's going to sink them on the second game of the season if it were to go poorly.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, Virginia's been really good in these games too. Their last, I mentioned that loss to Todd Golden in San Francisco, that's their last like big neutral floor loss. You know, they're not counting NCAA tournament games. Regular season, like neutral floor games, they've won five of their last six. Last year they spanked Baylor, beat Illinois on neutral floors. Now, I think obviously last year's co-ACC champion was a better roster. So that, you know, you can't take a lot from that. But the point is, you don't get to be like the program that Virginia is if you don't win these games pretty frequently. And so for Florida, that's kind of a next step thing under Todd Golden. It's a big challenge. And as Eric said, obviously you have big resume implications. I think when I look at Florida's schedule right now, if I have like one game hot takes, like, yeah, Michigan's win was nice. Like, obviously UNC Asheville's pretty good. Like, I do think it's interesting how late in the preseason, like suddenly Pitt went from being picked like 11th in the Almanac and stuff in the ACC to being like sixth in the ACC media poll. And like a lot of people think Pitt's going to be pretty good. And I think that's probably a good take just because like Guillermo Diaz-Graham had such a nice summer and Blake Henson is good at basketball and I thought they did really well in the portal at guard. Like that is a good team, I think. But, you know, I picked, for example, I'm already down one on the over-unders because I picked Damari Monsanto to go off against the Gators. And then Steve Forbes came out like hours after we recorded and said, I don't know if we get him back in time for Florida. So we thought we would. We don't know if we will. you know, so maybe Florida has a shot there in what will be a quad one at Wake, right? And Wake didn't play great in their opener. But, you know, this is a game, look, the committee does not care when this game is being played. They just care who wins. And really big opportunity for the Gators, obviously, missing Zion Pullen, but still a chance to win. Game two in the non-Kihei Clark era. And I think when you talk about Kihei, like, you have to understand, like, that's a big adjustment. Tony Bennett's talked about it all summer, you know, so opportunity for Florida here.
There's like so much going on in college basketball that things like this can be missed. But one of the craziest stories of the opening night of the season, well, not, I mean, it's not really a story, but Wake Forest was playing Elon, and Elon was up by 21 points in the first half. And it was like late in the first half, Elon was up by 21. And it was like, oh man, this might be like a very big epitome of brutality situation. And Wake Forest ended up winning by 23. So that was one of the big swings of opening night, was Wake Forest looking like Wake Forest looking like they might suffer a horrendous loss
against a bad team.
To a team that was 337th in KenPom last season. So the point being, I don't know what to expect from that Wake Forest team, but my night one overreaction is I don't think that's going to be a quad or one game for the Gators, but it very well could be. That's, again, that's big time night one overreaction. But it's good to be talking about these games. I'm excited for it. I'm sure you're very excited to be at this event live. So I hope a couple people are there to say hi to you.
Yeah, man. Should be fun. Always good to get yourself out and challenged early on. Certainly Florida will be challenged both schematically and by, you know, you don't get to play a first team All-American all the time. So it's kind of cool for Florida fans to see a player like Reese Beekman, who's everything that's good about college basketball. I will let Eric send us away.
Go Gators, and keep attacking closeouts.